complete chaos breaks out on American university campuses as entitled, immature, brainwashed students raise the Palestinian flag over Harvard. And dozens of agitators are arrested, zip-tied, and loaded onto buses without their bedtime snack. The good news is 80% of Americans favor Israel on the Gaza war, the other 20% being related to Ilhan Omar. And a conversation with Nir Alon, a survivor of October 7th, who has channeled his energies in co-founding Civil Squads of Israel. This is a great episode. I'm your talented and lovely host, Hanala Music, coming at you from the land of Israel with episode 190. Hope you are well. Hope you had a lovely Pesach. Personally, mine was a little challenging, dealing with a broken washing machine, a fractured rib, I'll tell you about that shortly, and a heat wave that descended upon Israel throughout the holiday. But never fear, I can take a fall, I can take the heat, and my husband can take the laundry to his mother's house. So we survived, and nobody went hungry. And I told my kids all throughout Yom Tov, there is no complaining that you're hungry because you guys are Sephardim, and you can eat rice, and you can eat bamba, and you can eat hummus. And had I married a Lubavitcher, you would be starving now. You'd be eating boiled chicken and beets. So chin up and finish the rice that Safta sent. My mother-in-law, God bless her, she cleans the rice, kamotzarich, three times, grain by grain, and then sent some to her favorite Ashkenazi daughter-in-law, who would never take the time to clean anything three times in order that people can eat it. If it has to be cleaned three times, it's just not worth it. Because I could live without rice for a week. But my husband, and I experienced this firsthand all the years that we spent Pesach in my mother's house, he gets very cranky if there's a rice deficiency in his bloodstream. So Baruch Hashem, everybody was happy and helpful. And I'm on the up and up. And yeah, other than sneezing, coughing, sniffling, laughing, sitting, lying down, hiking or doing anything remotely extraneous, I'm doing great. And how can you complain when there are people who are truly suffering? For example, Joanna King Slutsky. I did not make this up. She's a paid instructor and PhD candidate at Columbia studying theories of the imagination and poetry as interpreted through a Marxian lens. So she's basically a keffiyeh-wearing Looney Tune that the press felt they needed to hear from. This video clip has 28 million views on Twitter, not because she said anything brilliant, I could assure you that. Listen to this.
Why should the university be obligated to provide food to people who have taken over a building?
Well, first of all, we're saying that they're obligated to provide food to students who pay for a meal plan here.
But you mentioned that there was a request that food and water be brought in, unless I misunderstood.
To allow it to be brought in. I mean, well, I guess it's ultimately a question of what kind of community and obligation Columbia feels it has to its students. Do you want students to die of dehydration and starvation or get severely ill, even if they disagree with you? If the answer is no, then you should allow basic, I mean, it's crazy to say because we're on an Ivy League campus, but this is like basic humanitarian aid we're asking for. Like, could people please have a glass of water?
But they did put themselves in that very deliberately in that situation and in that position. So it seems like you're sort of saying, we want to be revolutionaries, we want to take over this building. Now would you please bring us food and water?
Nobody's asking them to bring anything. We're asking them to not violently stop us from bringing in basic humanitarian aid.
They're stopping the delivery of food?
We are looking for a commitment from them that they will not stop it violently.
But they haven't stopped it yet.
I don't know to what extent it has been attempted, but we're looking for a commitment.
Okay, first of all, water is free. It comes from the tap. Second of all, if you're going to get into politics, you probably should have a plan that lasts longer than day one. And third of all, why are the lunatics running the asylum? I listen to this girl's biography, okay? And I'm no academic, but I couldn't make heads and tails of this. She writes, well, this is her biography on Columbia's website. My dissertation is on fantasies, well, that's accurate, of limitless energy. That means nothing. In the transatlantic romantic imagination from 1760 to 1860. Okay, I Googled that. That era doesn't exist. My goal is to write a prehistory of metabolic rift, Marxist's term for the disruption of energy circuits caused by industrialization under capitalism, which, by the way, is the reason you all have keffiyehs that you ordered on Amazon for $12 because of capitalism. I am particularly interested in theories of the imagination and poetry as interpreted, blah, blah, blah. Prior to joining Columbia, I worked as a political strategist for leftist and progressive causes and remain active in the higher education labor movement. In the meantime, it seems the only thing Miss Lutsky has learned in Columbia is how to be a permanent, perpetual victim, a la the Palestinian people that she is so happy to die for, starve to death for, if her demands are not met. So what she's essentially saying is we want to destroy the university, we want to trespass and vandalize and threaten the Jewish students without any punishment, without any consequences. Oh, and I'd also appreciate a pie of pizza and a slushie with my activism. This is what we are dealing with. We are dealing with idiots. We are dealing with morons, absolute morons who are flushing their academic opportunities down the toilet to side with terrorists, violent, vicious, cruel, barbaric terrorists that they apparently have more in common with than their fellow Jewish students. I mean, the insanity has reached fever pitch in America, and it's if it wasn't so obscene, it would be hilarious. In the meantime, we have universities calling the National Guard, who hopefully will help reinstate some sort of order there, because at this point, we have hundreds of Jewish students who are afraid to set foot on campus. And that, my friends, is absolute insanity. I was listening to Dan Senor on the Call Me Back podcast. If you don't listen to it, he's brilliant. I highly recommend it. He had Rachel Goldberg pull in and her husband on following the release of the hostage video of their son Hirsch, where you see him speaking for 2 minutes, gaunt and miserable, with a stump where his arm used to be, the arm that was blown off when Hamas terrorists overtook the Nova Dance Festival, murdering hundreds of teens and partygoers at the Nova Festival, including Hirsch, who was hiding out in a reinforced security room with a bunch of other people when his arm was blown off, and then he was subsequently thrown into the back of the truck with a bleeding stump, not to be heard of for over 200 days. And Rachel says, she says, I don't understand how students at an American university could not care less that fellow American citizens are rotting in hell and spoiled, entitled American youth are turning their backs to their plight because American hostages don't matter if there are Palestinian babies dying because of Hamas. But whatever, when you have a degree in Marxist fantasy, then, you know, facts don't matter. So these people are not to be taken seriously. They are, however, to be taken to jail as hundreds of police officers enter Columbia University amidst these anti-Israel protests. Over 100 people were reportedly arrested almost a week after the Chabad rabbi of Columbia University and a group of Jewish students were forced to leave the university campus for their own safety during a pro-Hamas demonstration. Absolute insanity. If you go online, you can see some of the clips. We've been sharing them. We've been laughing at the lunacy, but really, it's sad times. And I've been saying this for 2 years now, but nobody's been listening except all the thousands of people who listen to this podcast. So you have been in the know, and you have known all along that people like Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib and all these machshefot who are in the White House using whatever power they have, whatever connections they have, whatever resources they have to continuously gaslight the Jewish people as we experience one of the darkest periods in modern history, all the while painting themselves as the victims. I mean, this is Gaza Lighting 101. Ilhan Omar retweeted a tweet from Senator Marsha Blackburn that, in my opinion, was fairly logical. She tweeted out, any student who has promoted terrorism or engaged in terrorist acts on behalf of Hamas should be immediately added to the terrorist watch list and placed on the TSA no-fly list. That makes sense to me. I mean, we're still taking off our sneakers in the airport because of terrorists. So, you know, if we're dealing with that again, let's crack down and not let them fly, right? Well, Ilhan Omar, she finds this terribly offensive and hurtful to the Muslim community. The poor, innocent, helpless, defensive, docile Islamists who are running loose all around the world, setting the West on fire. So she retweets Marsha Blackburn, adding her 2 cents, A sitting senator, she writes, labels Americans protesting against a foreign country accused of carrying out a genocide, fake news, funded with our tax dollars as terrorists, and puts a target on their backs to be attacked. And the kicker, she writes, this is insanely dangerous. And somehow no one will condemn it. Okay, lady, first of all, you need to be deported. Second of all, there is no genocide, you anti-Semite. Third of all, you have been fueling Jew hatred with your blood libels for years now. A sitting representative of the House perpetuating unrelenting blood libels against the Jewish people and Israel, lying every single time her nefarious mouth moves. These are not peaceful demonstrations. This is terrorism. This is domestic terrorism. This is anarchy. And she's such a behemoth. She's walking in the college where, by the way, her daughter attends. So let's connect the dots there. She's going as an innocent observer, but lo and behold, her daughter attends the school and is one of the prime agitators in all of this. And so she's walking in the campus and someone puts a mic in her face and she goes, all Jewish students should be safe here in the college. Those who are pro-genocide and those who are anti-genocide, which is a blood libel because there is no genocide. And the only genocide that did take place was against the Jewish people. So this morning, as we wake up and watch dozens of videos of Hamas campus occupations where young men and women are wearing Palestinian keffiyehs, preventing Jewish students from going to classes, reminiscent, by the way, of 1930s Poland and Germany, where students were not allowed in their universities. What is the difference, I ask you? What is the difference? There is none. We are watching history repeat itself as brainwashed Nazi youth disrupted public assemblies, blocked Jews from schools, and then eventually rounded them up for extermination. It's not a time to be silent. It's absolutely critical that every single American take issue with what's going on. If you haven't seen, there's a video going around with a curly-haired Jew who is literally not being permitted to pass through Hamas-occupied territory at UCLA. These students, with masks on their face, COVID masks, but masks nonetheless, they've taken over a shared space, including libraries at campuses across the U.S., so they can prevent Jews, Zionists, the evil Zionist entities, from entering and, in some cases, leaving their classrooms. They are forcibly removing Jewish students from the buildings that they are occupying. They are linking hands to block police and Jewish students with their professors at the forefront. Not only they're not permitted on campuses, but they're even stopping the media from getting in, carrying shields and wearing riot gear and breaking windows and basically occupying the entire university property and declaring intifada. That's what's happening. And it's as far as Utah, and it's in California. And the bottom line is, jihad is here in America. We invited it, and now we're going to have to deal with the consequences. The consequences of having Soros-funded Hamas terrorists attending our universities, purple and pink-haired lunatics breaking windows and lying through their teeth about what's happening here in Israel, demonizing the IDF, demonizing the Jewish people, demonizing Zionists who simply want a tiny little sliver of land that they can call their own. That's it. That's all we ask. Don't slaughter us in our beds. Don't run over us with cars. Don't attack us with axes. Just leave us the hell alone. That's it. That's all we're asking for. It doesn't take a college degree to understand how simple that is. And if the Hamas terrorists would stop being terrorists, we all could live happily ever after. But no, let's support savages. Let's align ourselves with barbarians, absolute barbarians, and do it because we are bleeding heart liberals and just so compassionate. And what about the Palestinian babies? What about the Palestinian babies? The only reason there are still Palestinian babies at all is because the IDF has been going out of their way to painstakingly operate in a urban warfare environment that is unparalleled to anything else that military analysts have seen in the last 100 years, and yet, they managed to do it with dignity and grace and humor and skill and, of course, morals, because we're Jews, and we're here to protect life and to sanctify life and to defend life and to protect our children. And these stupid university students don't understand the damage that they're doing to their reputations, to their colleges, and to the Democratic Party, which is going to be smashed into smithereens when Trump becomes president again. And I've been thinking, like, how do you communicate to these people? How do you get through to them? Imagine if we had a president, a leader that could string a set of cohesive thoughts together and express to the American people once and for all what our values actually are. Somebody that these students can look up to and want to emulate and be like. The president is a Democrat. He's in your party. But alas, he is MIA. While Vice President Kamala Harris is busy making kissy faces to Drew Barrymore on her morning show. So it's sad. It's sad that we don't have anyone that these young people can look up to that can give them the guidance that they need. Because I believe in the goodness of people, and I believe that they're misguided, and I believe that if they knew the truth, if they came here, if they saw my children, if they met the soldiers of the IDF, if they knew what we were dealing with, they would see things differently. But they refuse to see. They refuse to hear. Unless, of course, you call them the wrong pronoun, and then suddenly they're all ears. I just don't understand the cognitive dissonance. And like Lee Kern tweeted out, this is such a great tweet, I'm going to read it word for word. Pro-Palestinians and the left have scammed the world. They are anti-Semitic and have always been. Quote, believe all women, except for raped Jewish women. We need safe spaces for minorities, but chasing Jews off campus, that's okay. Life is complex and gender is a spectrum, but Jews are all white. Microaggressions are awful, but violent intifada against the Jews, that's good. Labeling someone with the wrong pronouns is outrageous. But calling Jews apartheid Zionazis, well, that's righteous. Self-determination for everyone is a good thing. But Jewish self-determination, Zionism, well, that's evil. Cultural appropriation is wrong, right? Blackface, wearing a Mexican sombrero on Halloween, egregious crimes against humanity. But wearing a keffiyeh in support of a terrorist group that want to kill Jews, that's nice. Center minority voices in their struggle. But speaking over Jews and constantly telling them who and what they are and what Zionism is, that's okay. Tokenism is racism. But here are my fringe extremist best friends who are Jews, who echo my anti-Jewish sentiment, so they're the real Jews. Punch a Nazi, but praise Muslims who call to exterminate Jews. Homophobia is bad, except from Muslims who want to kill Jews. Misogyny is bad, except from Muslims who want to destroy Jews. So add that to the fact that the civilian death toll in Gaza is a completely manipulated, incorrect number thrown out there by Hamas. But whatever, the president used it in his State of the Nation address, so it must be accurate. It's not. We have a terrorist group that uses child soldiers, human shields, and is holding 133 innocent men, women, and children still being held hostage. But not a word from these entitled brats who, by the way, are receiving funding, and this is not a conspiracy theory, from the Muslim Brotherhood, who have been targeting universities just because that's an effective way. That's an effective way. You infiltrate the universities, you spread your indoctrination, and it's all done with a bunch of slogans. Like, nobody knows what they're talking about. There was a video clip of a girl who literally had no idea why she was there. She said point blank, I need to get educated. But free Palestine. And that's what we're seeing. We're seeing all these slogans. Resistance by all necessary means. Rape is resistance. From the river to the sea, which basically means the destruction of Israel in its entirety. Ask any of them. They'll tell you October 7th was a justified act of resistance. But it also didn't happen. So, you know, explain that. Hamas are freedom fighters. Okay, yeah, they're, like my daughter said, they are freedom fighters. They fight against freedom. Globalize the Intifada. Globalize the Intifada. Google the Intifada. Look how many people died. Thousands of Israelis were butchered and blown to bits by terrorist savages wearing suicide vests, getting onto Israeli buses where men, women, and children were just going to and from school or work. This is who they're emulating. By the way, if anyone ever says that the Palestinians didn't invent anything, that's a lie. They invented the suicide vests. So, you know, at least they're good for Iran. And the bottom line is we have a bunch of useful idiots accepting terrorist blood money to spread false allegations of genocide, colonialism, occupation, apartheid, advocating for genocidal jihadist maniacs who hate Americans, hate America. These are very, very dangerous people, and these are who American students are supporting in the name of Palestine. What's next? I pity to think of it. Okay, a little positivity before we move on to my conversation with Nir Alon, the co-founder of the Civil Squads Unit, Kitat Hitkonenut, here in Israel. If you don't know what that is, you will know what that is soon, so stick around. You don't want to miss that conversation. And while you're at it, go ahead and share this podcast in your family WhatsApp chat and allow your loved ones to engage in meaningful conversation because of the brilliant things that I address here on the show. All right, Eden Golan, she is heading to Sweden to compete in the Eurovision Song Contest with her song, Hurricane, a beautiful girl with very long pink nails, unnecessarily long pink nails. But what do I know? What do I know what it takes to win Eurovision? I do hope that she can perform her song without being disrupted. I find that hard to believe, but, you know, I guess I will leave that to the Eurovision security team. The fact is, she has been advised not to leave her hotel room in Malmo, Sweden, the entire time that she's performing, which is insanity, which basically means her life could be in danger, which is insane in and of its own. But regardless, El Al did their best to make this a beautiful experience. I shared a video clip on my Beautiful Land of Israel page, and you see Eden Golan board the airplane, sitting in first class, and then you see the crew of El Al head out to the fields where, with flashlights, they spell out, "Good luck, Eden." And yeah, I wish her good luck. She's a beautiful young woman, and she's representing my people, and I hope she does so with grace and a lot of love. And if you live anywhere where you can vote, be sure to tune in and vote for Israel. All right, today I have the privilege of introducing a terrific guy, Nir Alon, a family man, a father, a husband, whose life was turned upside down on October 7th when he found himself seeking refuge along with his entire family in the mamad of his childhood home. In that moment, he recognized that it was up to him and only up to him to protect his family. And as soon as the dust settled, he was off and running, dedicating his life, his entire life now, to the mission of Civil Squads of Israel, with a commitment that he will never again be caught off guard and unable to protect his family and his community. So today we're going to speak to Nir Alon and hear what he's been up to, how he's infused the last 6 months of his life with purpose, with passion and resilience that is driving him forward in his mission to ensure that every single Israeli citizen, civilian, can sleep peacefully at night, knowing that their neighborhood, their kibbutz, their moshav is being protected by people who are well prepared and have what they need to defend off, God forbid, attackers. So without further ado, Nir Alon, co-founder of the Civil Squads of Israel. Hello, Nir. Welcome to the Weekly Squeeze. Thank you for making the time to be here.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. How was camping with the kids?
It was awesome. It was awesome.
It was awesome.
The first time since October 7th that I took them out, and it was important as a family. It was important.
Definitely. I love how Israelis just appreciate the land and make the most of the weather when it's permissible to get out and, you know, go fishing or camping or do all those fun things that Americans are not into. All right. Such a pleasure to have you, the opportunity to talk to you and have you share with my listeners what you've been through since October 7th. Although to me and most Israelis, until all the hostages come home, it's just one long October 7th, 7 months of Hamas terrorism. But from what I hear, you have refused to let the darkness, the sadness, the despair consume you. Instead, you've channeled your energy, your skills, your experience into creating what I call yesh me'ayin, something out of nothing.
For as we speak,
there's hundreds of volunteers in the small towns and communities in Israel's periphery, specifically the Gaza envelope, training in what we call in Hebrew kitat hitkonenut, right?
Hitkonenut, yes.
From the word hachana, to prepare.
Yeah.
Okay. So to get started, can you tell us, as much as you're comfortable, what you experienced on October 7th, so my listeners can get a deeper appreciation for the important work that you're now doing with the Civil Squads security teams?
Yes. So first of all, thank you for having me. I really appreciate that you've given me the opportunity to talk in front of your audience. I was born and raised in Kibbutz Sufa, which is really close, about 1 kilometer from Gaza border on the south. And right now, in those days, I live in Ra'anana, which is a kind of a medium city north to Tel Aviv. But I was born and raised in Kibbutz Sufa. And during October 7th, October 6th, actually, we went to my mom's house to celebrate the second holiday of Sukkot.
Simchat Torah.
Yeah, Chag Torah, exactly. And there is a kind of a memorial site that we did for Hadar Golding, Zichrono Livracha. He was an Israeli soldier who died in the tunnels of Hamas before October 7th. And we, the kibbutz, and there is the members of the kibbutz were inspired by him. And so basically we created a memorial site for him. It's like a hill on the corner of the kibbutz. And I took my kids and my wife, my parents' wife, and my mom. We were 7 people in this holiday in my kibbutz. We went there and we climbed up the hill. We took pictures. It's in front of Gaza border, like right in front of Gaza border. So you go up the hill and you see all the border with Gaza. Beautiful place.
Wow. For people who haven't been to Israel, there's memorials all over the country for fallen soldiers and victims of terrorism. Right here on the park on the corner, they already have a memorial for 12 chayalim that fell from Beit Shemesh. And they planted olive trees and so on. So it's fairly common. And Israelis pay their respects. So kol hakavod that you're teaching your children that this is important.
Yeah. And for me, especially the story behind that was important to inspire my kids and to show them that although there are a lot of people, like a lot of falling, we still need to remember and we have to do that
each
in a respectful
and everyone,
way.
Right.
So to take them to this hill was like an important thing for me. And we stood on the hill, we took a lot of pictures, we saw Gaza Strip, everything was quiet. And then we went home, ate dinner and went to sleep. And during the morning on Saturday, October 7th, we woke up to there's not a better way to describe it besides war. 6:30 a.m. Alarms, and we ran to the shelter. As I said, we were in the house, my wife, my children, my wife, my parents' wife, and my
your wife's parents.
My wife's parents, my mom, and my dog, 7 people and a dog. We all ran to the shelter about, I don't know, 10 meters square.
Yeah, they're small rooms. My shelter is also a small room, but you only have like 15 seconds. So
yeah, we ran fast.
It's immediately panic. As soon as there's a siren, immediately it's panic.
Yeah. And about 20 minutes later, we started to hear shootings all over the place. And I'm not talking about like a pistol. I'm talking about AK-47 and machine guns. Like you hear when for somebody that was in the army, like you immediately understand that like there's wars going on outside. And we heard like there's like a snapping voice from the AK-47 when he hit the wall. It's like bang, bang. And my daughter asked me what's happened. So I told her there is a electric wire cable that snapped. And this is why the noise, because I didn't want them to be aware of what's going on. And then we in that specific moment, we had some Wi-Fi so we can like read the news on Ynet. And we read there are terrorists attacking the kibbutzes. And I started to hear screaming in Arabic and a lot of shooting. And I realized what happened. I asked everyone kindly to be quiet. My wife's parents, they have a hearing device.
Hearing
they can't
aids.
Hear. Yeah, they can't hear properly. And they were talking loudly. So I needed to make sure that I keep them quiet. So I wrote on a note. I wrote to them, listen, there are terrorists in the kibbutz. Please be quiet. Since I showed them the letter, they realized what happened and they were silent. And since then, we're talking about, my guess will be 7 hours or over extreme fighting.
That you were sitting in the shelter with, what you said, 8 people and a dog?
And 7 people and a dog in the shelter.
On a hot day, right. On a hot day, windows closed, no resources, not prepared.
Nothing. Before, once, in the moment when I heard fires, actually, I ran out of the shelter. All my family screaming to me, don't go out, don't go out. But in my think of mind, I was like, there is a war going on. I don't know what's going on. I don't have how to prepare myself, how to defend myself. And I need to bring some resources home. So I ran outside. I locked all the door, sealed all the windows, took some water, took some bags. And later on, I explained what we did with those bags. But we took some bags and I took a knife. That's all I had to protect myself.
You don't carry a weapon?
After that, I carried. I tried to avoid it for 20 years since I left the army. I refused to buy a pistol because we were told that everything is secure. There is a fence that can hold everything that's going on, and everything is quiet and everything will be okay. So I didn't want to expose my children to weapons. So I
Well, as somebody, I don't frequent those neighborhoods often. I live in central Israel. Is there an army presence? Was there an army presence on a regular, you know, day-to-day basis? Just because of the fact that you live on the border, like the kids weren't exposed to the fact that it's a more dangerous environment?
There is an issue with that. Like before, a year ago, before October 7th, there was an army, but then for some decision, and I don't want to go into politics, but they pull out all the army outside, and there were no army in the Sufa, and there were only, during October 7th, we have only 4 rifles. That's it. That's what.
And the closest police station?
The police station is an hour from us.
Is that Sderot?
It's in Sderot, yes.
And we know what happened there.
Yes. So it was a combination of a well-planned attack on our settlements, and nobody knew what's happened, and we're all shocked. And during those, after I ran out from the shelter, took the things in, I wanted to make sure that we can lock the shelter. So I went outside, I told my wife, hey, listen, try to lock the door. When she couldn't, then I realized that we're not safe because we can't lock.
You're sitting ducks. You're sitting ducks.
Exactly. So during those 7 hours, what I did was holding the hand of the door, making sure that nobody can walk in. And I literally can describe the horrors of my daughter's face. That it still haunts me, to be honest. One second. I don't wish anyone to see the horror of their daughter's face during that moment. Not even the people that I hate, which I don't hate, but if I did, I wouldn't wish them to see and to experience such a thing. And
to be completely vulnerable when your responsibility is to protect your children.
Yes.
Sounds like the most awful feeling.
Yes.
It's okay. This is a safe space.
I cannot describe how, for me personally, I'm a big guy. I'm like almost 1.9 meters. I'm pretty big. For me, that lack of confidence and ability to protect my loved ones, that was horrible, horrible.
But you're here.
Yeah. And after we finished that horror and we got evacuated, 2 things that happened almost immediately. One, I went to buy a pistol to protect my family and make sure that it will never happen again. Second of all, I had after 2 days, to be honest, when I came back from, I didn't say that. A day after I finished we got evacuated, I went to reserve duty. I got a text message saying that I need to go to reserve duty. I went to the north. I was there for a week. After a week, I called my home to see how everybody's doing. And I heard what's going on. I heard in my wife's voice. I immediately talked to my commander and went straight back home. All the windows were shut. The door was locked. Everything was dark. And I realized that now we have to deal with post-trauma. And it was really two difficult days. And I couldn't wake up off the bed. I couldn't do anything. I was broken. But then...
Now, when did the information come in that you mentioned in our phone call that a childhood friend of yours is still held hostage? I mean, it came in spurts, but until you understood the full extent, it was like death by a thousand cuts, I imagine.
Yeah, we're talking about, I think the full information arrived about 5 to 10 days after. Once I got back from the reserve duty, then I realized that one of my closest friends, and when I mean closest friend, I mean one that I grew up with literally like until the end of the school, we were like together with everything, like everything that you can imagine of 10 to 70 years old, the people, the children are doing. We did that together. And then I heard that his family, his family name before was Konringold. Once they got married, they changed it to Shoham. So Tal and Adi Shoham and their children, Yael and Nave, were kidnapped to Gaza. It broke me. It broke me. I was not okay. And then I realized that I have two options. The first option is to sit in my bed, cry a lot, because I did cry a lot, and do nothing. But then my daughter came to me and told me, Dad, what can we do? And that sentence changed my life. I realized that I need to do something. There's something that I need to do in order to rise up and do something. And then I realized, then I decided and I founded a nonprofit organization called Israel Civil Squads. And basically the mission of this organization was to equip all the civil squads in Israel. Between 0 to 7 kilometers from the border. We raised about $400,000 from donors. And beside that, we got equipment worth about $1 million of a ceramic vest that we started to equip the civil squads, yeah, the communities. And it started small, but then it got real big.
I want to break it down for people listening, because I know there's this idea that Israel is a militarized country. I mean, we spend, I think, 5% of our GDP on defense. I think it's $27 billion. I Googled that, but
yeah,
it's a lot of money.
Yeah.
So I think people have trouble understanding how could it be that we need like a grassroots organization to do what many believe is the IDF's responsibility. Now, obviously, in the wake of October 7th, it became painfully obvious that our soldiers can't be everywhere always. So let's break it down how the civil squads now, how they play this pivotal role when it comes to establishing that never again means never again. Because what happened was a failure of communication, and we never want to be in that situation again. So now we have a grassroots movement to implement security in all of these neighborhoods that are vulnerable, but it's complicated and expensive and takes a lot of work, and it's practically a full-time job, which is what you've been preoccupying yourself for the last few months. So explain to people, just in short, what's missing. In other words, what security has been missing and what you're trying to, you know, the spaces you're trying to fill right now.
Okay. So you were referring about the IDF and why there is a lack of equipment. First of all, the Israel Civil Squads, it's not part of the IDF. The civil squad, there are small group of people inside the settlements. And the settlements are close to the border. If we're talking about 7 kilometers, that's like nothing. 20 minutes, the terrorists are already in. So even if there is IDF people around the area, the idea behind that was to give the first reaction would be from inside the settlement. Okay? That's the first thing. The second thing is, as a every big group like the IDF or the government or whatever, they're really good of making big things, but the small things they're lacking. Meaning, they don't really know what is the need of those settlements. And I, as a member of the Kibbutz Sufa, and the one that is related to all those settlements, I can, like, with one phone call, I created a data that I know exactly what they need, when, and why. This is something that I think that as a high-tech person, I'm a CPA in my background, but I work in a high-tech company and we come from a high-tech nation.
Background.
So, yeah, from a high-tech background. So it was very easy for us to create like a big data that includes all the specific needs for the civil squads. So this is the first thing that we did that no one did before. Like, we know exactly who needs and what, and there were no like duplicates. The first thing. The second thing is that bureaucracy in Israel, the bureaucracy is really, really difficult. For example, it's been known for a lot of years that Kibbutz Sufa is like right on the border, but it still didn't avoid them to leave us with four weapons. So what I was trying to do is to say, hey, we do need the IDF weapons, because once there is, for example, if there is a different prime minister or a different member of the Knesset that think that have a different perspective, as we saw in October 7, they can take all the weapon and move it to other places. I want civil squads, all the civil squads settlement, to have their own equipment. That way, nobody can touch it.
Right.
Nobody
independent of the government, independent of the IDF.
Exactly. And then we realize that once we do that, they can take care of their own. So we started with that. We started with ceramic vests, helmets, boots, all that stuff. And then we realized that there is a lot of things that still are not being handled. For example, fire equipment.
Fire safety. I want to explain to people, because we have very creative and innovative enemies, and they're always coming up with new ways to hurt us, you know, rigged gasoline balloons, drones, anything they can get their hands on. So it's very challenging to counter these constantly evolving terrorist tactics that they have. So you need a lot of equipment. A gun is not going to cut it when your enemies are determined. I told you this on the phone call. My in-laws who live in Modi'in Elite, Kiryat Sefer, a completely Haredi neighborhood, they put bars on their window. They spent thousands of shekels to put bars on their windows for the first time in 30 years. And it was sad, but you got to do what you got to do.
That's something that I think that a lot of people don't realize abroad, is that like there is a real threat right now. There is a real threat on every settlement in Israel. That's the truth. Like, people don't realize that, like
they're targets.
When I walk down right now in the middle of Ra'anana, which is a city in the center, I don't feel safe without my pistol. I don't feel safe my children to walk in the middle of the street. And I will feel safer if I can equip a civil squad in Ra'anana, in Sufa, whatever, if I can equip them with that they be able to defend themselves just for protection, nothing else. And I can buy them a fire equipment to cease fire. Then that's all what I need. That is all what we need for the first step.
Right. But, and just to prove that it in fact is the answer, we know what happened in Kibbutz Nir Am, a woman named Inbar Lieberman, and this made the press all over. She literally saved her community from two dozen terrorists who were advancing, she created like a fortress because she was prepared.
The same thing happened with the Kibbutz Sufa. Not a lot of people know, but four people in the civil squad of Sufa were about to prevent about 30 to 40 terrorists to walk into the kibbutz. They themselves were able to protect Sufa from 40 terrorists until the helicopter came above us. There were about 150 terrorists on the orchard. The helicopter. This is the only reason why you didn't read about Sufa, the same as you read about Be'eri.
I never even heard of Kibbutz Sufa until I spoke to you.
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of settlements were exactly the same. First of all, big miracle. there was a big miracle for a lot of settlements on the south. Second of all, the people that knew how to handle it and were equipped accordingly with some of the things were able to protect themselves. People that weren't equipped and obviously it depends about the amount of people that about of terrorists that were trying to breach the border. But also, I truly believe that if those settlements were equipped enough, it wouldn't happen.
Would have been a different story.
Yeah, that's what I believe. And I, one of my best friends in the kibbutz, Ido Chubara, zichrono livracha, he was part of the civil squads in Sufa, and he got shot. And I believe that if he had the right equipment, the ceramic vest and a helmet and everything that he needed, he would still be alive. He would be here with us. And right now, I made it as my life mission, literally, to make sure that it would never happen. Never again. Not just a word, not just a sentence. To make sure that each settlement gets whatever they need. All the security equipment gear, fire extinguisher, everything that they need to make sure that it's not happening again.
Right, and not just to save lives, to save property, to save crops, to save businesses. Tell me a little bit about, I saw the video clip I'll share it in the Weekly Squeeze WhatsApp chat of the guys training to put out fires. How important is that? So, wow. You know, for people who don't know, when it's summer here, I mean, the whole countryside can go up in a blaze from one match.
Yeah, as we said before, they're getting smart, the Hamas, and they did they realized that they can send explosive balloons to our borders and basically create fire all over the place. I'm not even talking about security when a small kid can touch the balloon, and let's not talk about that. But when we talk about corpses, even if just in my regional council when I was living here in Motza Ezorit Eshkol, millions of shekel were demolished because of those fires. And basically, I have a good friend with me who helped me to establish a civil squad, and we reach out to Australian firefighters that wanted to come and volunteer. They have a different method that's
method
that only takes a full equipment for one settlement cost $6,000. That's it. We don't need a fire truck. We don't need anything. We need a blower and a little bit of water to extinguish the fire, and that's it with our technique.
And that's the difference between millions of dollars of destruction.
Yes.
A piece of equipment.
And when I saw it happen, I was like...
Mind blown, right?
Mind blown. I was like, we were never told about, like, we never... Nobody explained to us that we can like just block all the fire and extinguish it with such a small amount of water and a little bit technique. And since we realized that, we said, okay, we need people to know it. And right now, there are two firefighters in Israel, volunteers from Australia, with one of my friend from the nonprofit organization. They cross all the country, south to the north. Teaching the civil squads and all the settlements how to do that. And we get amazing feedbacks from people that realize that it's so easy to save millions of shekels of corpse. Like, and if we're talking right now, let's think about scrubs. Yeah. Let's think about like settlements in the north that right now it's like a restricted area. The only people that are there, those are like few farmers. That's it. And if we're talking about a fire over there, that's like they lose all their income. And with a little help from somebody, a nice guy that knows what he's doing from Australia, we managed to save millions of shekels of crop. That's like, for me, it's mind-blowing.
And it must be so empowering, or you gain some of that power back that Hamas took away on October 7th.
That's
the whole idea.
I always tell my wife that this is like a healing for me. That's what makes me heal. Like I choose to make an act, to make an impression. And there is a saying in Hebrew, say tikkun olam. I truly believe that every one of us should make an impact in this world, because we're just like, you know, we're just like skin and bone. That's what we are. If we don't do an impact, we're just skin and bones. And my mission is, first of all, to educate my kids and to show them that anything is possible, and to make an act, to take an action, not just stand to the side and do nothing, to show them that it's possible to defend the South. Even if you get like to the, even if you're in on the bottom of the hill, you can still go all the way up. And it's going to be hard. It's going to be difficult, but it's possible.
Well, that's the story of the Jewish people. Whenever exactly. we were in harm's way, I mean, the Maccabees, they just rose up, they grabbed their swords, they sharpened them, and they did what needed to be done. Because this is unfortunately the story of the Jewish people and a challenge that we've been facing here.
To be humble,
for the beginning of time.
I'm not a Maccabee yet. I wish I was, but I'm not yet.
You're close enough, a modern Maccabee. Let me ask you some technical things, because I would love people listening to be motivated to help support you guys. But a few questions. First of all, how many people are in each group? Like each
civil squad?
Yeah.
We're talking about between 17 to 25 people, but the equipment, we don't, that's the funny thing. We don't need equipment for each guy. If we're talking about fire safety, we're talking about one gear. We're talking about a few blowers and few backpacks, water backpacks. Like, and that's
because you're a team, you're working together.
Yes. And that's like, for me to see that it's happened, I was like, whoa, that's amazing. Like, how?
Well, Israelis are the most capable people on the planet. They just were at this crazy disadvantage on October 7th, which is so tragically unfortunate.
Yeah.
But if, you know, if the minds and the money come together, you know, the sky's the limit. And you should never have to look at your daughter and say, I can't protect you. You should say, of course I planned this. I thought about this. I prepared. And we've been training and I got you, you know. Do you have to be in the IDF to be part of the civil squads? Like, can I show up and volunteer?
It depends. There is the security civil squad. Then you have to be an IDF. But if you want to be a firefighter in the civil squad, you don't have to be in the IDF. You can volunteer. And okay. I encourage people to make an act, to volunteer. If they're in Israel, go and volunteer. If you're abroad, open your heart, open your wallet, help us to do that. We need your help. We need people to help us doing that thing. And I promise you guys, we're not going to let it happen again. If it's up to me, we're going to protect ourselves, no matter what. We're not going to stay still and sit down quietly and wait it to happen again. It's not just not going to happen.
Wow. Kol hakavod. So everybody listening, I'm going to put a link in the show notes that you can check out the website. You have a very thorough website, which explains and breaks down exactly what you do, who's on your team, what you need, where the money's going. I'll just share real quick while we're here, because this is the stuff I found interesting. Here we have, how do we do it? Our mission. Oh, the gear. So we're talking bulletproof vests, medic backpacks, helmets, boots, radio systems, control room equipment, encrypted technologies, monoculars, binoculars, video and optical surveillance systems. I mean, security is serious business in our neck of the woods.
Yeah.
So you can't cut corners. You need it all, and it all has to operate well and be ready when you need it. And we try to get the best gear possible. So that's why this stuff adds up so quickly. How much of it is funded or sponsored by the government? Can you speak on that for a little bit?
Zero. Round zero. Since I began this organization, I don't look on the right side, I don't look on the left side. Everyone that willing to help, I will hug him and I will join him in. Right now, it's not about left, it's not about right, it's about protecting our nation. That's what it's all about. And I don't really care if you're a left wing or a white wing or you're Arabic, Druze, Bedouin, I don't care. Whenever you want to join, whenever you want to help us out, come help us out, because we need the help and we want to make it happen.
What's your vision? If I ask you in 6 months from now, if everything goes as you wish, what would be your vision?
I have 6 months is the mission. It's not a vision. The vision, we're talking about 6 years. But okay.
My mission, tachlis, six months.
My mission for the past 6 months is, first of all, to finish the project of the fire extinguisher that we're doing right now.
Right, especially with summer coming.
just a rough number, 6,000 per settlement. We're talking about more than 200 settlements across the border. It's a lot of money that we need. And we need to equipment. We start doing that. Right now we raised some of that, but we need more in order to make sure that it's happened.
That you could adopt a kibbutz, and if you have 25 grand to throw around, and I know some of you do, you rich Americans over there, you have for $25,000 you can literally equip an entire kibbutz with everything they need. So that's yes. The bottom line, that's the amount.
Yeah. And I would say that after that, there's still a lot of work for us, because once we finish equip them, then those people will want to go back to their homes, and this is where we need to help them once again.
Right, because tens of thousands of Israelis are literally cannot sleep in their beds because it's not yet safe enough.
Again, I'm not trying to be the government. The government will help, but there's a lot of things that the government can do, and I'm not judging the government. I'm saying a fact. There's a lot of stuff. For example, I'll give you a small example, okay? Ido's kids, three beautiful kids, that his wife was stayed alone with them. Somebody needs to help over there, okay? The government helps, the Bituach Lumi helps, but there are small stuff that needs to be taken care of. My mission is to make sure that those kids will not lack anything at all. So if we're talking about long-term mission, I want to help all the people that got hurt from October 7th. I want to help people that come back to their homes and help them re-innovate. There's a lot of stuff that needs to go on. Right now, we need to prioritize. So first, there is like emergency equipment, yada, yada. Then we're talking about health, like internal health that needs to be taken care of. Because the government gave us a 24 treatment. It's been 6 months. For example, my wife right now, she was doing 24 treatment over. Now we need to pay it from our own money pocket. I'm sure it's going to be solved, but there's a lot of people along the way, they're going to fall between the cracks. And I want to make sure.
This war has been extremely expensive and hurt every Israeli in their pocket. So in general, any dollar you send in our direction is going to be put to good use. We're not exactly sitting pretty now.
And I think one thing that makes us different is that since I came from Sufa and I established this non-organization, I can guarantee that minimum 95% of your money will be invested in this gear, in those missions, because we don't take salary. And I'm not going to do that. We're going to invest that money in our people. That's what it's all about. And that's what I'm saying to everyone that joins in. I tell them, if you're thinking about money, not here. We're not about taking money. We're about investing that money. We're about taking. I want to make sure that donor that give us $100,000, he can see them. He can literally see them in equipment. And this is what I'm doing right now. And
right. It doesn't just disappear into some account somewhere.
And that's immediately why our donors keep donate. One of my donors, I see
the Taniel Miller Foundation.
We're working with Israel Friends. It's a big organization that help us. And for small amounts, we're working with Taniel Miller Foundation. And also there is the Christian Zionist group led by Pastor Victor Stiersky, who's amazing. People that love Israel, that want to help from the first moment started to help us out. And one of them, for example, to tell you how the donors trust us, one of the donors literally told us, listen, guys, I'm going to give you $100,000 each year until Messiah will come. Okay? Like, there is a reason why people donate. They see their money. They see almost 90-something percent of investment. They see all their money. They see where it goes. We're very transparent, like, this is my life mission. This is what I'm doing right now. This is what needs to be done. And we're not going to hold back. We're going to move ahead.
Listen, I love it. I've been following your progress. I've been sharing it, introducing my audience on social media and on the podcast to all the amazing people involved in this. And I encourage people to contribute. I mean, if you're lying in bed in America thinking, how can I help my Israeli brothers and sisters? This is such a great way to do it. If you don't want to donate $5, $100, your Meiser money, if you want to collect money, maybe do it as a school project or a shul project. You can literally adopt a kibbutz and have the merit, keeping them safe, the children and the wives and the women and the animals and the crops and the field. And it's just such an important cause.
And I encourage all my brothers out there abroad, and I call them my brothers because they are brothers to me. All our Jewish brothers and friends and all our allies, make an action, make an impact. Don't sit there. You're gonna be judged by history, not by me. Take an action. Do that right now. This is the time to act. This is the time to help. If you want to join in, join in. If you want to come and volunteer in Israel, go here. Go do that. Be
proactive.
Be proactive and make your conscience clear.
And also establish a country where you can move to and know that the work has been done so that you can live here in peace and you can live on the border and build a beautiful home like my dream, you know, to live on a kibbutz somewhere and have the space and let my children run free and not worry that they're, God forbid, in danger. Because, you know, as a unit, as a team, as a nation, we work together to protect the Jewish people.
And one thing to say that I truly, and I'm not just saying that, I truly believe that I admire people that chose to come to Israel and make an aliyah and come to live here. Because I know
what
it
takes. Thank you very much.
You know, I know what it takes. And I know that I've been working in the U.S. in the summer camps in a URJ movement. And I know what it takes. And for me to see someone that's passionate about Israel and choose to make an action and make aliyah and Hannah, I know how hard it is.
You know that I left my pool and my Costco card and my garage and my minivan.
I truly admire you. Not just saying,
thank you.
My heart.
Not about me. We're not talking about me. I'm just here. I'm literally here to help. Like I said, I live in Central Israel. October 7th wasn't as traumatizing for me as it was for many Israelis. So I just look at the opportunities available for me. And I try to use them to help.
And I encourage all the people, even people that like think, and I've getting a lot of a lot of questions from brothers abroad. How can I help? And I said them three options. One, made an aliyah. If you can't make aliyah, come to volunteer. If you can't make aliyah, if you can volunteer, open your
wallet. Send cash.
That's how we can make it happen. And to all the our brothers out there that they think like, what can I do? We love you, we need your support, and we do care about you, and we want to make sure. And I said that I remember when I was a counselor in the summer camp, and one of the kids told me, what if it would happen here in like one of the Jewish American people in the U.S. get attacked. So I said, and then I said, As I was protecting my brothers in Israel, if I would see someone get affected, even if it's in the U.S., I would make an action because you're my brother. The same way it goes around. We have to help each other.
Yeah, we're in this together. We are definitely in this together.
There's no other way.
Nir, thank you so much for sharing your inspiring story, the tough times that you've been through. Thank you for co-founding the Civil Squads. It's truly remarkable what you're doing. The dedication to your community and making a difference. And as an Israeli, I thank you. I'm grateful for your leadership and your commitment to such an important cause. And I encourage everyone listening to make a donation today, whatever you can. And I'll be able to call up Nir in a couple hours and say, don't ask. This rich guy who listens to my podcast, he's taking on a whole bunch of kibbutzim. You're good to go. And yeah, let's celebrate.
And to all our Jewish friends who hear me, Hashem yevarech lachem, and keep doing whatever you're doing. Take an action. Take an impact. Hannah, I can't. There's not enough word to thank you for what you're doing. Seriously,
I ain't do anything, and I wish I could. I'm gonna come out. I'm gonna come out, and I'm gonna video you guys and share that with people, and let people see all the work that's going in and the incredible effort you guys are making. Because, yeah, it's a beautiful thing to see. I'm very proud.
Thank you. I'll stop talking before I start crying.
Crying again? We love crying. It's great for downloads.
But I'll just say that Here it goes. Yeah.
We've been through a lot. We've really been through a lot.
Thank you, guys. Thank you for everything.
You bet. You bet, Nir. It's going to be good. It's going to be good. Your heart's in the right place. There's going to be bracha in it. It's going to be good.
Bezrat Hashem. Bezrat Hashem.
So there you have it, episode 190 of the Weekly Squeeze podcast. Head over to my show note links. Make a donation to Civil Squads. Every single one of you, $18, $36, $100, whatever you can manage, deeply appreciated. And we will make sure it gets to the right people right away. Don't forget to leave me a 5-star rating, share this podcast with a friend, and I will see you next week.